Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello, happy Easter and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, you might be about to tackle a large egg-shaped piece of chocolate. Well, stay tuned because we're going to be diving into the soaring cocoa prices this Easter and all of the reasons behind it. Plus, we're going to discuss the impact of the rising cost of small businesses in the tourism sector specifically. And I'm going to be joined by two industry experts to go through all of that. And later, we'll explore the situation in Taiwan amidst the US-China chip war. So stay tuned for all of that. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on X at StockNT. Now, even if it seems a little bit early, Easter's often seen as the start of the summer tourist season. Now, while Ireland is still really popular with tourists, those people who are involved in the industry are warning now that high costs are endangering the livelihoods of some of those who are involved in tourism. The Irish Tourism Industry Confederation published a report this week outlining their concerns, and I'm joined now by Eoin O'Mara Walsh, who is CEO of the Irish Tourism Industry Confederation, and also the economist Jim Power, who wrote the report. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy.
Eoin, I'm going to start off with you. We spoke this time last year, actually, about the Irish tourism industry was doing very well coming back after COVID, really positive figures. How would you categorise the sentiment of your sector as we move into the summer season of 2024?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed bag, if truth be known. So demand is strong, or looks likely to be strong, particularly from the North American market. And that's such a key market for Irish tourism because they're big spenders. They spend on average 8 days in Ireland and they tour the regions. Mm. So that's a really attractive market and a really positive one. So that's the good news. Other markets, Britain, continental Europe, the domestic market looks soft. But I suppose the big kind of concerns within Irish tourism businesses at the moment and Irish hospitality businesses at the moment are cost and capacity pressures because, you know, costs of business have really soared. There's a lot of new labour measures have come into effect quite recently, which are going to add to the cost of businesses. And I think the thing to remember in tourism that lots of businesses in this sector are SMEs or in regional Ireland have very thin profit margins. So that's a big concern. And then there's also capacity pressures. The government have taken up a lot of the tourism bedrooms for refugees and asylum seekers. There's a cap at Dublin Airport. There's a lot of sort of capacity issues as well, which are likely to be a handbrake on growth. So it's a mixed bag, as I say.
Mm. Jim, I might bring you in here now. You compiled this report for the industry body, and I think it's very clear throughout that there's that apprehension within the findings of what you have. And we'll get into the new challenges that centre around government-induced labour costs and all of that in a moment. But I think it would be worthwhile just starting us off with how important tourism is in Ireland, because we often think, oh yeah, we're great at pharma, we've got agriculture and tech. But where does tourism sit as a contributor to the exchequer?
185,000 people employed in the tourism industry directly. That's food and hospitality, accommodation, and also the attractions. Okay, so it's a major employer. It accounts for about 13% of employment in the economy, and that compares to 4%, for example, for agriculture, 6% for construction, and so on. So it is a major contributor from an employment perspective. And of course, those employees spend their wages in the economy. They generate employment taxes and so on for the exchequer. So tourism is our biggest indigenous industry, you know, from an exchequer perspective, from an employment perspective.
Mm. Jim, do you think that sometimes it's hard to get policymakers to kind of recognise that and understand that?
Yes, it is, because the industry first, and this is, I guess, typical of the SME sector. You know, it's made up of restaurants, it's made up of hotels, it's made up of guest houses, it's made up of the various attractions that are in place. So it's a very diversified type of product. But the important point is that all of those facets feed into the tourism product. And as I say, it is the biggest indigenous industry. And it's the view that's often taken by some is that, listen, tourism is going to happen regardless of what we do. So, you know, they don't pay as much attention to it as perhaps they should. But on the other hand, we do have very ambitious targets set by the Department of Tourism set by Folge Ireland, Tourism Ireland, about the potential to grow the industry and employment into the future. So there's, I think there's always this little bit of a disconnect between certain elements of the policy making bodies and the targets that are set by government. Because one of the things about tourism that is really important is its regional footprint. You know, for many towns, villages, and indeed cities around the country, tourism is the lifeblood. In rural areas particularly, very little else going on other than tourism. And, you know, that is one of the challenges, of course, because in Ireland, particularly with the weather, there is a short enough shoulder period. But the it's the regional dispersion of the activity and the jobs that I think sets tourism apart from other sectors of the economy.
Owen, I'll bring you back in here. You know, Jim in this report sets out a number of challenges, and we can go through them in a moment. But looking at them, they're all there or thereabouts, largely the same as they were last year. Rising prices, challenges of the Ukraine accommodation, energy costs, cost of operational business, availability of staff. Now this new element that I see in this report is about the government-induced labour costs. You might just talk us through the collection of things that these small SMEs are now having to deal with from a wage perspective.
Sure, Mandy. And it's a perfect storm to a certain extent because, as I said earlier, you know, this sector, it's made up of about 40,000 businesses, but the vast majority are SMEs, a lot of them in regional Ireland. They all pretty much operate off thin profit margins. And they were all dealing with escalating kind of input costs, you know, for the last 12 months, 24 months anyway, whether that be energy or insurance or whatever. But now, just from the start of this year, there is new labour measures brought in by government policy, you know, everything from an increase in minimum wage to pension auto-enrollment to statutory sick pay, you know, all good measures in their own right. But when you take them as a whole, it's adding an awful lot to the payroll of businesses. And Jim's report that he did for the Irish Tourism Industry Confederation was very revealing because it shows very clearly that there's a disproportionate impact of this government policy on the tourism and hospitality sector. So in 2024 alone, there'll be €456 million additional cost on payroll within the tourism sector and as much as €1.4 billion by 2026. And that's just from government measures. So obviously, you know, irregular wage trends are above and beyond that. So for a small business, for, you know, a regional small business, you know, less than 10 staff, you know, delivering a service or a product, you know, there's two choices. Do you pass that on to the consumer, which risks damaging demand, or do you absorb it to the bottom line, which risks the very business's viability? You know, so neither of those are good outcomes for business. And when you have such a mixed picture on the demand side of the equation, you know, what we're saying very clearly, and Jim made it very, very very clearly in the report, is that government need to step in and need to introduce some sort of offset or mitigation measures to help businesses through this period, because I'm always quite anxious to say that, you know, businesses don't have a problem paying hardworking staff for the really good work that they do, and you know, it's a high cost of living environment, and businesses, you know, are prepared to pay more and offer better terms. But for an SME sector with thin profit margins, if the viability of that business is threatened, then government need to step in with some sort of offset measure to ease the burden.
What do you say, Owen, and then to ICTU, who were also out this week, saying that this is only what workers deserved, and in some ways they're playing catch up. And what's wrong with levelling up the playing field when it comes to their wages now?
Yeah, I noticed those comments from ICTU during the week, and I think the thing to stress is that, you know, any responsible business owner has no issue with paying staff more for the work that they do. The issue, I suppose, is that, you know, the full wallop of these additional costs from government is falling at the feet of the employer. And particularly in our sector with really thin profit margins and the demand picture looking very mixed, it puts too much of a burden too quickly on businesses. And we think government need to step in, and whether it's VAT at 9% or reform of employers' PRSI or some sort of measure that will help businesses navigate their way through this choppy water. I mean, tourism is the great employer in Ireland. I mean, Jim mentioned it. We're the biggest Indigenous industry. We're the biggest regional employer. You know, we're a labour intensive business. We're a people business. So, you know, having viable, strong businesses that employ staff is really critical.
Jim, I'll bring you back in here. One of the things Owen's mentioned there that the organisation want of Simon Harris when he comes in as Taoiseach is to reverse that change last year from the VAT increase of from 9% to 13.5%. How much would a measure like that cost the government? And indeed, if it isn't reversed, how much might it cost the businesses? I.e., have you looked at the impact of this if you roll it forward? We saw PwC coming out with some insolvency numbers this week. What's your assessment of that VAT piece?
Well, I think the first point to make, Mandy, is that government was warned last September when it was pushing ahead with increasing the VAT rate from 9 to 13.5 that it would cost jobs. And one of the problems was it wasn't necessarily the increase in the VAT rate per se, okay, even though that was significant, it's a 50% increase. But the important point was that it was coming at a time when a lot of other pressures were building on the sector. And, you know, not least the cost of doing business, particularly in relation to energy and labour costs. So it came at a really, really bad time. And that's why the damage it has done, you know, has been, I think, quite disproportionate. If it was brought from 9% back to 13.5%, the Department of Finance suggests that it would cost $750 million annually in taxes foregone. Okay, but the cost to the tourism industry of the problems it's having at the moment could be as high as $1.1 billion, according to Fulge Ireland. So actually, the damage that's being done to the hospitality and tourism sector at the moment would, in my view, far outweigh the taxes that are foregone. I think the Department of Finance's attitude is typical of knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing. I mean, the reality is that 284,000 people employed directly, a lot of other jobs dependent on those jobs. That represents a huge injection of tax revenue and wages into the economy, and the multiplier effect is very, very significant. So, I think the other really important point is, Mandy, that from the 1st of September this year, well, going back, I guess, to the 1st of September last year, but the tourism sector has just been hit with a series of measures that it is estimated by the Irish government's Economic and Evaluation Service would add about 6.6% to the wage bill for hospitality businesses. And that would equate to an increase in wages of $456 million. And that is on top of normal wage increases that have been delivered. So, and as Owen said there, and I would agree with him, you know, these measures that are introduced, are apart from the VAT rate, are socially desirable, you know, and that they have a positive societal impact, but they are being imposed on businesses. And I think to achieve those social benefits, it is necessary that the businesses are compensated in some way. And, you know, we would like to see the VAT rate being brought back to 9%, I think, on a permanent basis. I've always been a fan of the lower VAT rate, because I think it's certainly helpful for businesses and was instrumental in rebuilding tourism after 2011. But there are also things that can be done with PRSI. But the bottom line is that the cost that's been taken out of the sector needs to be put back in by government. Otherwise, we're going to continue to see these businesses. And it was interesting, you know, what the unions were saying, that the complaints from business are overdone, that the labour market reforms are modest. I like the response from Neil MacDonald in Ismay, who said that while the unions describe these changes as modest, the open market has decided otherwise. And this is backed up by the PwC insolvency data. You know, insolvency is up 4.1% in the first quarter. 85% of those are SMEs, and the hospitality sector is the dominant sector there that's been affected. And there are no surprises, because, you know, hospitality businesses and tourism generally is a highly labour intensive activity. And if you increase the cost of that labour, well, you are going to do serious damage to margins. And that is now what's happening.
Owen, I'm going to bring you back in here then. So you want the VAT rate addressed again, you want some changes on the PRSI, and also you want more government supports. But are SMEs and businesses using the existing supports that are already there?
Well, there was a couple of measures brought in the last budget. One was sort of an increased cost of business support scheme, which was for €257 million, but it was economy-wide. It was spread over about 145,000 businesses. It doesn't kick in, I think, until April 1st. And because it's economy-wide, obviously the tourism and hospitality sector will only be able to get so much of it. And there was a very modest amount of money given in the budget for downstream tourism businesses, so the likes of attractions and activity centres, who were impacted by a loss of beds in the region because of the refugee situation. But that's kind of, you know, that scheme was just announced in the last couple of weeks, and it's not significant enough to help those businesses. So more needs to be done. Jim is right. And I think what's interesting about kind of this economic analysis of tourism's issues at the moment is that, you know, tourism, where it's configured at the moment within government structures and with departmental structures, it's in the wrong place. It's in with media and arts and sports and Gaeltacht and all those other good things, but it really should be in an economic portfolio. So we've long said that tourism should sit alongside the likes of enterprise and trade and employment. You know, you should have Fáilte Ireland and Tourism Ireland, which are the state agencies for tourism, sitting alongside the IDA and Enterprise Ireland, because it has to be thought of as an economic force for good. And that means decisions and policies have to be taken with that in mind. And at the moment, the sector has been poorly served in that regard.
I 100% agree with you there. I definitely think that in order to have those big questions like VAT, like PRSI, and those economic realities to be really properly considered, it has to sit within one of those economic departments. Yeah. Jim, can I bring you back in? One of the things I wanted to ask about before we close out on this is the accommodation issue. There's no way of getting around this. Like, industry and tourism, of course, depends on some indigenous activity, but largely it's people coming to the country. There's just not the supply there anymore. What is the effect of that, as you see it from an economic perspective, on the industry?
Yeah, well, Mandy, there's, you know, as a tourist, you go someplace, certain things that make a destination attractive is the availability of decent accommodation. It's having decent restaurants, it's having friendly people. You know, all of those things are an integral part of the hospitality and tourism offering. The restaurant piece is under significant pressure at the moment. And, you know, the Restaurant Association of Ireland have made it very clear the number of members they are seeing shutting down over the last 6 months, over 370. That's very significant. But then you have the accommodation issue. You know, there are now towns in Ireland that would have had a strong tourism footprint that basically don't have any accommodation because the hotels have been taken for humanitarian reasons. So clearly, if there's a lack of availability of accommodation, the tourists won't come, and suddenly the economic lifeblood of those towns and areas will be decimated, and you just won't have tourists coming there. That's the reality. And likewise with the restaurant piece, if there's not a decent, diversified restaurant offering, people won't come. So it's a pretty binary choice here. You know, we address these issues or we do serious long-term damage to what is the most important Indigenous industry we have in the country.
Owen, I'm going to leave the final word to you on this. And if you could just be brief, please, because time is upon us. We've got a new Taoiseach coming in the next couple of weeks, appointed by Dáil Éireann. How hopeful are you that he might be amenable to your proposals, or any sense that he might even be listening to your concerns?
Well, hopefully he's listening to your program, Mandy. Hopefully it's a key part of his weekly calendar. But he would have got a copy of the report Jim did for us last week. That's on his desk. He did make some very positive soundings when he took over leadership of Fine Gael about supporting Indigenous industries and supporting the SME sector. So hopefully he sees that tourism is just too important to take for granted. You know, it can't be outsourced. It can't be offshored. We're here to stay. It's a huge regional employer. If you look along parts of the Wild Atlantic Way, there's very little other things going on but for tourism. So it has to be nurtured. It has to be supported. And hopefully some of the policies that we've asked for, he sees favour in.
Well, we'll watch this space with interest. And if the incoming Taoiseach is tuning in, then he's more than welcome to come on to Taking Stock any week of his choosing. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That was The Economist, Jim Power, and Owen O'Mara Walsh, CEO of the Irish Tourism Industry Confederation. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks a lot, Mandy.
This is News Talks Taking Stock. And after the break, we'll speak to a journalist who's just returned from Taiwan. There's much talk of global warfare given the situations in both Ukraine and the Middle East. But for some, the most likely tinderbox will be much further east in Taiwan between it and its closest neighbour, China. Joss Glancy, who is the News Review editor of the Sunday Times, thinks that China and Taiwan is the issue that could actually reshape the entire century, having just spent a week in Taiwan. Hello, Joss. You're very welcome to News Talks Taking Stock.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Now, Josh, we're going to get into your experience, and it was a very, very interesting article that you wrote, and I suppose lots of the stuff in it I didn't expect. But before we delve into your own recent trip, maybe just start by giving us a short history of why and how Taiwan is even contested as a country in its own right by China.
Sure. Well, Taiwan is an island about the size of Belgium. And it sits about 150 miles off the coast of Southeast China. And it's always had a slightly ambiguous role in Chinese history. There have been periods of Chinese history where it has been part of the overall country of China. But there have also been periods where it's been a society apart and a place apart. And it existed on the margins of Chinese history, really, until 1949, which was the conclusion of the Chinese Civil War between Mao Zedong's communists and Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists. And the communists won that war, and Chiang Kai-shek got on a boat and retreated to Taiwan with about 2 million of his soldiers, a huge army. Mm. The population of Taiwan then was only 4 million, and he took a huge hoard of great treasures from Chinese history. He took a troop of elephants and he basically set up China in exile in Taiwan. And for decades, he ruled under an emergency law, so it wasn't a democracy. And it became a kind of alternative China. And Chiang Kai-shek's hope was that actually one day Taiwan would almost sort of retake China, or the Republic of China, as he called it. And get rid of the Communist Party there. Mm. And so at that point, Taiwan has become almost a sort of central feature of Chinese politics. For the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, their hope is to reunify China. And it's almost a kind of unfinished business from the Civil War. It's a kind of middle finger to their ideology that sits just off their coast. And for Taiwan, well, they know they have to live with China. It's their huge, powerful, wealthy neighbor, but they're trying to forge their own path, possibly more towards independence. But they exist in this gray, diplomatic gray area. Mm. So it's a very unusual place in that way.
And in terms of the Taiwanese people themselves, are the majority of people who live there keen to be a sovereign nation, or are there pro-Chinese elements in society? How does that balance lie?
Well, it really, really does depend who you ask. Generally, the two main parties are the Kuomintang, KMT, and the DDP, which is and of the two parties, I would say the KMT, the Kuomintang, tend to be people who were descended from those soldiers who came over with Chiang Kai-shek, his Kuomintang army, and they tend to lean more towards some sort of unification with China, or at least an accommodation with China. But the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, tend to lean more towards independence. They will speak openly of independence. I talked with DPP politicians who, they think of Taiwan as an independent sovereign nation. Mm. But the problem they have is that most of the world does not recognize them as such. It can't, because China insists on it. So even America, probably its most important ally, has to do business with China and therefore does not recognize Taiwan.
Yeah, and that, I suppose, brings me to my next question is, they are very important strategically from a geopolitical perspective now. And maybe you'd explain to us exactly why that is, because obviously all eyes are still on the relationship between America and China. But you might just explain why Taiwan is involved in that, involved in that relationship also.
Yes, in many ways, Taiwan has become the kind of critical tug of war between these two giant superpowers, the rising superpower China and the existing superpower America. I would encourage anyone to actually just go and look at a map, and look at where Taiwan is. And then you look at the whole Chinese seaboard from Korea, Japan, the Philippines. It's all hemmed in by American allies. America has naval bases across those islands. And Taiwan sits right in the middle of that. And it is, in a way, a barrier, an American-supported barrier to Chinese expansion across the Western Pacific. And they call that the first island chain. So in many ways, by taking Taiwan, China could open up, it would allow it to potentially dominate that whole part of the Pacific region. And it would call into question America's alliances with anyone from Japan to Australia. But it's also about microchips. Taiwan has, it manufactures a huge majority of the world's advanced semiconductors. Now, these power everything from computers to iPhones to aeroplanes, and particularly the really, really tiny ones, the ones that go in our iPhones and make them ever smaller and faster, are almost all made in Taiwan. They make 92% of the world's most advanced microchips. It's an incredible near monopoly. And it's very, very hard to replicate what they do. It's a very minute, intricate supply chain. And so war in Taiwan, well, Bloomberg estimated it would cost the world $10 trillion, which would make Russia and Ukraine look like a bad afternoon at the races. But it also totally changes the dynamics in terms of who gets these very advanced microchips. So that is another reason why Taiwan is absolutely critical. And I guess the third reason is the slightly more nebulous idea of, well, this is a free country. And it's that people don't want to be taken by China. And so there is a sense of standing up for democracy and for people's right to self-determination, although whether you'd want to risk World War III over that is another matter.
Well, that's a really good synopsis. The geographical issue, the trade issue and the microchips, which we'll definitely come back to, and then the freedom issue. And you mentioned war there and the possibility of it, which I will revert to in a moment, because I think that's an important part of this discussion. But I want to turn now for a second, Josh, if I can, to your recent experience there. You might tell us about what it's like in Taiwan and whether or not the people there are as aware as we are looking at it that there might be something imminent, or are they living like a society in that way, or are they willfully blind to the type of threats that you've just mentioned?
I must say, I wasn't quite sure what to expect in Taiwan. I'd never been there before. It was part of the reason I wanted to do this piece. And when I landed, it struck me immediately how very Chinese it feels there. I spent some time in China, but with a critical difference. It's very obviously free. There isn't any sense of authoritarianism. You can go up and talk to anyone. There aren't police on every street corner like there are in Beijing. And it feels, I spoke to one Taiwanese MP, and he said, yeah, people come here and they expect to feel like they're in Israel or Ukraine, but actually it's more like being in Los Angeles. There's a kind of mellowness to it, a kind of, you know, it's almost Polynesian a little bit in its chill factor. But yet also very prosperous, very ambitious. You know, they have this incredible microchip industry. They do a lot of other high-tech stuff too. It's a reasonably wealthy place, very high, well-educated. But there is a sense that you have this giant geopolitical megalodon sort of sitting 100 miles off their coast that could come and swallow them up. And I don't think people are really fully able to comprehend. It's quite hard, isn't it? If you imagine living with that for 50 years, you just learn to live with it. I asked people a lot about this. They said, yeah, you know, it's like a second skin to us. We know it's there. We think about it, but we have our lives to be getting on with. And in a way, it's too big an issue to, it would weigh you down constantly if you gave it too much thought. But their military preparations and their overall readiness levels are not high enough. I think most experts agree on that now. So they're trying to shift that at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, reading it, I didn't really expect the type of lifestyle. I don't know what I was expecting, but I think definitely it would have been more authoritarian than you have described. Maybe just give us an idea of the young people that you encountered and their prospects there, because as you say, they are producing over 90% of the world's chips that we will all depend on every day in our lives. But yeah, young people, are they staying there? Are they moving away? Or do they have any sort of qualms about remaining there with this threat looming over them?
I think on the whole, young people have a pretty good time in Taiwan. There's very good educational opportunities. There's very good employment opportunities. They do have to do now a year of military service, but it's quite low key at the moment. But yes, some will move abroad because a lot come to America. Actually, many come to Britain for their education, to do masters and things. But they'll often go back because, you know, there's money to be made there and there's a good life to be lived there. And I met these young law students at Taiwan National University, and, you know, they said, well, again, you know, if it happens, it happens, but we'll deal with it then. But we just want to get on with the things that students want to get on with, building a career, you know, finding a partner, all that sort of thing. So, that, you know, it is odd because most students don't have to think about sort of existential threat the way they do. It is a very large diaspora Taiwan has. So, you know, many of them would think, oh, I have a cousin in Canada, maybe even a cousin in China, a cousin in America. You know, there are places they might come or move to if the worst happened.
Yeah, we mentioned there the issue of possible impending war, and I was struck by one of the statistics in your article that 67% of US experts polled in January by the Center for Strategic and International Studies said that expected crisis in Taiwan this year. Now, you know, how long is a piece of string? You don't know when that might happen. But what I wanted to try and explore with you is that issue of the microchips that they're producing 90% of the world for the world's devices, etc. The implications that might have for us, because on the one hand, it doesn't sound like much. Okay, they're going to affect the world supply of microchips, and it does sound like something out of a Bond villain movie. But so did the Russians cutting off the supply of gas to Europe, and that happened. Yeah. So you might just explain to us, if that were to happen, what could be the economic and physical consequences of that supply being withdrawn if there were a rapprochement between, or an engagement, sorry, between America and China?
Well, it would be a massive economic hit, particularly in the short term. I think I mentioned earlier, Bloomberg estimated it's $10 trillion because you also have the Taiwan Straits is one of the main shipping routes in the region. The microchips, you know, I think Apple wouldn't be able to make its iPhones. Companies like Nvidia would not be able to plow ahead with developing the new AI tools because they need those hyper-fast chips to do it. Some of the more mundane or slower chips we could recreate. We would have to have a massive drive in the West and elsewhere in Korea to up our production levels. So in the short term, it would be chaos. And there would be a run on iPhones and smartphones. And there would be, you know, stock markets would collapse. And big tech would be in a complete disarray. We could probably, as I say, we could probably replicate a lot of the chip making in due course. But the really, really tiny stuff, the really fast stuff that does our phones, that would be tricky. So, you know, given how much we all use our phones, I would say that's a fairly substantial change.
Fairly substantial change, yeah. Look, Josh, time is nearly upon us, but before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you very quickly, what, if anything, or what effect, if any, do you think that a Trump victory might mean for the situation in Taiwan? Has he given any indication of how he might treat this if he does return to office next year?
Well, that is a great question, isn't it? Trump's always a wild card. So what he says and what he does isn't always the same. What he says from one week to the next. Generally, he's been quite anti-China. You know, he took a tough stance on China. But he has also recently said some negative things about Taiwan, about how they've, you know, stolen the American chip manufacturing capacity. He isn't a fan of using American armies abroad. He doesn't like the idea of war. It's expensive. So the answer is we don't know. But I think the broad feeling in Taiwan and elsewhere is that Trump's instincts are isolationist, and that's probably bad news for them. But beyond that, they can't be sure.
Well, look, if you want to read more about this, it's called Inside Taiwan's China Crisis That Could Start World War III. It is by Josh Clancy, who is the news review editor of the Sunday Times. And Josh, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock this Easter weekend, and you might be partaking in a little bit of chocolate over the holiday. So you'll be interested to learn that chocolate or cocoa prices have never been higher than they are right now. So stay tuned, because after the break, I'll be looking into why it's become such a luxury item. Now you're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Mandy Johnston. Take a quick listen to this. Yes, because it's Easter weekend and you might be on the very first of your chocolate eggs. And while they might have been reasonably priced this year, that may all about to be set to change, as the price of cocoa beans has literally exploded in the last few months. Earlier this month, cocoa futures in London traded at record highs. And what's behind this rise and who exactly benefits from it? Well, I'm delighted that Susanna Savage, who is the commodities correspondent for the Financial Times, joins me on the line now. Susanna, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi there.
Now, we're all concerned about what we pay for chocolate, and we'll get into the price and the futures and all that in a moment. But you might start us off by contextualising this for us. Where does most of the world cocoa product actually come from?
Yeah, so around 2/3 of the world's cocoa beans, which are used to make chocolate, comes from two countries in West Africa, Ivory Coast and Ghana.
So there's a lot going on at the moment in terms of the issues that are affecting their pricing, and you might just take us through what the current pricing is and how that even compares to this time last year.
Yeah, so essentially, cocoa futures traded in New York soared through the $10,000 per ton barrier earlier this week, which is absolutely unheard of. That represents a tripling in the last year. So really, they've absolutely exploded.
And Susanna, you've been looking at this in quite some details. Why is this happening now? What can you put this down to?
So as we said, a lot of the world's supply comes from just two countries. And those two countries have been hit really hard, firstly by bad weather, and secondly by disease affecting their cocoa trees in their plantations. And, you know, these farmers are often very poor, and ironically or not ironically, but they've been, you know, dealing with very low prices for decades. So that means that their wages have been low and they haven't been able to invest in their plantations. So they often have very old trees, which are particularly vulnerable to disease and to bad weather. And this year has seen both. So harvests have been really well below average. Their yields are really down, and this has led to a global shortage. And I think we're going into the third year of a cocoa bean deficit. Mm. So the world's really just not got enough beans.
Meanwhile, demand is growing, isn't that right?
Yes, exactly. Because Europe eats a lot of chocolate, the US eats a lot of chocolate, but also Asian countries are increasingly eating more chocolate. So demand for chocolate is growing, while the number of cocoa beans used to make it is going down.
Mm. And you mentioned the issues that are affecting the price there now. And we'll get into some of those, which are largely, a lot of them, climate related or weather related. But just about the farmers for a second. So if we're seeing these record prices now, how much of the market value do they actually get?
So this is really interesting, because the way the price is set in Ivory Coast and Ghana is based on a sort of running average from 18 months ago that the government takes, and the government sell forward, and then they give farmers a price. So farmers will currently be seeing, what they're currently receiving is the price of cocoa on global markets around 18 months ago. And that's also slightly, you know, it's not quite a direct transfer of money, because, for example, the Ghanaian government takes a bit of that off in order to, what they say, you know, is to provide services such as spraying crops with pesticides. Mm. So one of the farmers I spoke to in Ghana said even though prices on the New York and London exchanges were incredibly high, he was receiving less than $2,000 per ton. Mm. Even though prices are now at $10,000 per ton, so they will see higher prices, but not for a long time, and not at the sort of levels that we're seeing on the exchanges.
That's really interesting. And of course, if they're not seeing the returns or getting a fair share of the market price, that, I suppose, limits their ability to reinvest in their own farms.
Exactly. So normally how the market would function is high prices because of a shortage of supply and an excessive demand would rebalance that supply demand. So farmers would plant more, we'd see an increase in supply, and that would bring prices down. But firstly, it takes a long time to grow a cocoa plantation, so it's hard to respond even in the first place. And then there's an extra lag time because of this pricing mechanism in those countries.
Mm. And Susanna, you might just talk to us a little bit about the cocoa cartel, which sounds like a fantastic thing, but it's a very serious, obviously, business endeavour by a number of governments based on, I think, the OPEC model. Can you talk to us through what that is and what that hopes to achieve?
Yes. So basically, Ghana and Ivory Coast decided that they were being hard done by or their farmers were in the pricing of cocoa. And so they set up a body modelled on OPEC, what you have for oil, to try and set the price and to set a, what they call a living income differential, which is $400 added on to the price to try and raise farmers' incomes. Mm. It's had some success, but, you know, farmers say that the companies have found ways around it other ways to sort of reduce the price elsewhere so that it hasn't, because it's baked into the price. Farmers say they're not really seeing the benefit fully of this. So it remains to be seen whether, you know, farmers' incomes are actually going to go up.
You know, again, as you said previously, it takes a long time for these things to trickle down. Meanwhile, what about us, the consumers? How are the producers changing the product that we might see in our shelves, and how is it affecting pricing?
Yes, so cocoa, so chocolate companies hit with these prices, you know, paying record prices for cocoa beans or cocoa butter, rather. They have to pass on these costs to consumers eventually, they say. And so what they're doing, you'll see an increase in prices. I think the consumer group, which found that Easter eggs in the UK, for example, have increased by around 50% on average. But you'll also see products maybe shrinking in size while staying the same price, which is called shrinkflation. Mm. So that's something you might notice, that your favourite chocolate bar is a little bit smaller than before.
Yeah, and it doesn't make you feel better about eating even more of it when the products are getting smaller. What about the EU, Susanna? Any movement there, nearer to where we are on this issue?
Yes, so the EU has new legislation coming into force which bans certain products, including cocoa beans, from being sold in the bloc that come from deforested land. Now, this is a big problem for cocoa and coffee and other products affected, because historically, this is what has happened in Côte d'Ivoire, in Ivory Coast, in Ghana. Farmers, when they want to increase their revenues, they have planted cocoa plantations on deforested land and deforested the land in order to do that. But it's also, you know, proving that cocoa doesn't come from newly deforested land involves a lot of technology. It involves, you know, geolocation data, and that costs money. Now, there's a sort of some debate over who's going to end up bearing that cost of compliance. Mm. And some fears from NGOs that it might be the farmers themselves, that the big companies push back these extra costs onto the farmers, leaving them further impoverished.
Yeah, and it surely could affect supply even more.
Yeah, exactly. So this will also, you know, there's a risk that this could mean that some of the big chocolate processors and chocolate companies don't want to source from certain areas, and so this could really reduce their supplies and add further problems to this global shortfall of cocoa beans.
Mm. You mentioned futures and buying for futures in chocolate, and looking at that stock to consumption ratio. When that actually trickles down into the profitability of a company or the workforce, how do we see all of that affecting major companies around the world at the moment? Are they losing staff? Are they rationalizing staff? Is it affecting it to that degree?
Yes, some of the big chocolate makers or chocolatiers have announced cuts, including Barry Callebaut and Hershey. So some of the big names are having to trim their staff. You know, eventually we're going to see cocoa prices affect chocolate even more, and this could have an impact on sales. So right now the Easter egg costs that we're seeing, which are very expensive, this is cocoa that was bought some time ago. The current record high cocoa prices, those are yet to filter through. And so once those start to hit chocolate bars, those prices will be even higher. And the risk for these big chocolate companies is that then you see consumers turning their back on chocolate because it's just too expensive. So these companies see their sales go down, their profits go down, and then they may have to take even further measures.
Mm. So it's a bit like energy last year. We're still not seeing the full effects of the real price as it's been traded, really.
Exactly. It's exactly like that, yes.
Well, yeah, sadly, this is all proof positive that things can always get worse. And we're dreading the day when chocolate becomes a luxury good out of our reach. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Susanna Savage, who is the commodities correspondent for the Financial Times. Susanna, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much, Mandy.
Well, that's all for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thanks to all of my guests today, and thanks to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane were on research, and Hugh Gutta-Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments about any of today's items, please do get in touch on takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day and have a very happy Easter.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.